From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. While the war in Iraq carries on, there's another war going on closer to home, in American culture. Generational warfare is underway, in print and on the net, where you'll find an anti-baby boomer website that sells t-shirts and hats that say die already, or clocks that count down the days until boomers die off. Today, boomer backlash. Who's angry and why?
You know, you grew up with Summer of Love, Summer of Woodstock, 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 Kennedy's, Kennedy's, Camelot, Camelot, Camelot. You know, and everything's reflected in the span of boomer accomplishment. It's just sort of unoriginal.
Jeff Gordon here on boomer nostalgia. More from him in a moment. Also, why blaming boomers is nothing less than ungrateful.
Boomer critics always say, well, boomers are taking credit for everything. But I think that right now, hating baby boomers has become the last acceptable prejudice in society. And boomers take it with good cheer.
And a boomer novelist takes a hard look at his generation.
I think the boomer generation has elevated consumerism into an art form. And I don't think that is our generation's most attractive quality.
Jeff Gordonier is a card-carrying Gen Xer. According to Gordonier, the 60s just don't resonate with Gen Xers. What's more, many Gen Xers feel, at best, annoyance with boomers, and at worst, a simmering rage. In his new book, X Saves the World, Gordonier makes the case for why Gen X has the perfect qualities to improve the world they inherit from the boomers. He told Steve Paulson that Gen Xers are underrated, but have the right stuff.
We're sort of like all those bugs you find wriggling under a log. You know, when you kick a log in the woods and you find all these bugs squirming and crawling around. And you think, why did I disturb them? I should have let those bugs just sit there and be happy and squirm in darkness. I think a lot of Xers feel that way. And in the early 90s, the media beast took a grand interest in us and then gradually lost interest. And I think we operate better with lower expectations like that.
Now, people say that Gen X is a group of people that's sandwiched between the baby boomers and the millennials, which may not be a pretty place because you could sort of get forgotten about, right?
Yeah, it's a big sandwich, you know? Those are big pieces of bread. You know, the boomers are about 80 million strong, and I mean, we're being loose with the numbers here, and the millennials are about 78 million, 80 million strong. And the Xers are about half that. People say 46 million. So it's just a smaller demographic. It's a smaller clump.
And you are a Gen Xer yourself, right?
Yeah, I was born New Year's Eve 1966, actually. So I'm right in the pocket of it. My first summer was the summer of love. And I'm sure I mocked it mercilessly, even at 6 months old. I'm sure I was snickering even as a baby.
Let's talk about where the identity of Gen X came from. For instance, the Richard Linklater movie Slacker and the Douglas Copeland novel Generation X. So, can you tell me about those two works?
Oh, wow. As works of art, they're both extremely strange. I mean, if you go back and read the book or watch the film Slacker, it's striking how odd they are structurally. They aren't really fiction. They aren't really nonfiction. And they capture the essence of a time in American history, I guess, cultural history, that most people just passed over. And they capture the essence, the spirit of a strange new group of young people who are coming up and basically drifting around, traveling a lot, hanging out in coffee houses, going to hear bands, playing in bands, like, you know, making, burning tapes for each other, and you know, and it was different. It was a very different way of being than you had from the boomers, who had at that point tasted brie cheese and become yuppies.
The other thing that comes out from, I mean, not just talking with you but other people is, or I should say, reading your book, is there's a certain amount of anger towards the boomers. And, you know, I mean, sort of the charge that's leveled is, you know, they're hopelessly nostalgic, they're utterly self-absorbed. Do you feel that way?
No. I was just, you know, playing around. No. I mean, in some ways, I don't. I mean, in some ways, it's a joke. You know what I mean? Part of the book is meant to be sort of hyperbolically humorous. But, yeah, I guess the anger is there. There was something. I tell you what it is. It's like, as an Xer, you feel a little like Keanu Reeves in The Matrix when he's in that gelatinous tub and he's hooked up to all the tubes and wires and stuff's being poured into his head and his spine. Like, that's how we are with this boomer nostalgia. If you grow up with it, it's just sort of pumped into you at such a relentless rate that it becomes really tiresome. You know, you grow up with Summer of Love, Summer of Love, Summer of Woodstock, 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 Kennedy's, Kennedy's, Camelot, Camelot, Camelot. You know, and everything's reflected in the span of Boomer accomplishment, that legacy. And it's just sort of unoriginal. You know, like in medical circles, there's this cool term that I love called synaptic rutting. And what it essentially means is that, like, if you drive the same way home to work every day, or you go to the supermarket and buy the same things every day, it's actually bad for your brain. Like, you should force your brain into new combinations, new routes, so that your synapses don't dry up, basically, and turn into ruts. And I feel like our country, from the standpoint of cultural conversation, is sort of synaptically rutted. You know, if you turn on TV news in particular, everything is compared to Woodstock. Everything is compared to the Summer of Love. And these become these shop-worn, knee-jerk, shorthand references, right? And I guess that's where the anger, when you ask about anger, that it's you get sick of that.
Now, you're kind of making fun of the Boomer nostalgia. Now, there is another strain that you hear among some Gen Xers, which is far angrier, frankly. I mean, there are those T-shirts that say, die already, you know? I mean, sort of like counting the days down to when the Boomers die off. What do you make of that?
Well, I didn't want to be that mean because I still wanted the Boomers to be tricked into buying my book. You know, and be tricked into coming to my readings. And then I figured, you know, I could tell them to die already. No, I think that anger, well, that's a little bit of scapegoating. I don't know that I'd personally go that far, you know, but there are, for a lot of Xers, there is embedded in us this feeling of having been shafted and this feeling that our cultural accomplishments really haven't gotten their due. You know, I mean, like, let's be honest, like, what's probably the most important business, not just in America, but in the world right now? Google, right? Okay, Google is not just like a massive company and worth gazillions of in stock, but it's defining, you know, how the world does business. It's defining how you look at Earth itself, how you find information. How can you go through the day without Googling stuff? No, not anymore. Well, Google was started by Larry Page and Sergey Brin, two Gen Xers. No, you know, nobody gives us credit for that.
The criticism that you'll often hear from baby boomers when they talk about Gen X is that, you know, this younger generation is cynical, kind of disaffected, everything is ironical. They sort of can't take anything too seriously. And that translates into politics. You know, they can't sort of like mobilize into a movement. What do you make of that?
Well, their movements failed. Why should we do what they did?
Did they fail?
Sure, I think most of them
did. The gay rights movement.
That's true. There are things that were successful, but I think that a lot of those modes of protest became moldy and you know, sort of stopped working. There's a point at which those methods become ineffective, and so different methods take hold. You're absolutely right to point. I mean, you know, I'm being sweeping for the, you know, point of amusement, but there's an interesting point in Barack Obama's first book, Dreams from My Father. And it's really telling. He's at this anti-apartheid rally at Occidental College, where he went for a couple of years in California. And he's, you know, taking part in it, and he believes in this cause. And there's chants, there are picket signs, you know, there are sort of onstage theatrics. And he's self-aware in the book, self-conscious enough to say that he really doubts whether this is effective. He doubts whether this whole staged rally is really going to have any impact on global politics, or even anybody's mindset at all. I thought that was fascinating that he would admit to that in the book. Now, this is a guy who, if he has had lapses into cynicism, they clearly didn't stop him. He's the Democratic nominee for the presidency, right? So mm-hmm. he's worked his whole life to try and make an impact. So it's not like he just threw in the towel, but that he had doubts like that is sort of X-ish, I think. And I think that, like, if you look at that ironic sensibility, well, where's the crowning place that it crops up? Well, obviously, Stephen Colbert and Jon Stewart in The Daily Show. Now, are they just irrelevant comedians? I mean, I think they probably say they are. Mm-hmm.
Well, they certainly want to say, you know, don't take us too seriously. We're just trying to
be funny. Yeah, they say we're just making people laugh. You know, we get too much media attention. But the fact is, they're truth tellers, and they've really, for a lot of young people, they've affected the way we see the democratic process. And you know, a lot of times they give you a certain clarity when you're watching them, and especially after watching the news, you're like, oh, yeah, that's right. That was kind of bogus. And you know, the joke will just clear the air. So in a way, that's a new manifestation of, dare I say it, dissent You know, that just it just appears in a different form.
There is, I mean, on the one hand, there's kind of this nervous anxiety among Xers that they're going to get skipped over. You know, it's going to go straight from boomers to the millennials. I mean, part of it is just demographics. There aren't as many Xers around. And on the other hand, you could say the Xers are kind of ruling the world, certainly on the technology front. I mean, all the dot-com companies you mentioned, starting with Google and going on down, I mean, they're the ones, I mean, sure, they're not politically in charge necessarily, but economically, I mean, this is the group that's kind of ruling the world, isn't it? Or at least ruling the United States.
Yeah, I agree. I think so. That's, I mean, it's probably why I wrote the book, actually, to say that, you know, because nobody was noting that actually Xers kind of discreetly got a seat at the, you know, head of the table. And particularly in business, yeah, and technology, Google, YouTube, Meetup.com, Amazon.com, these companies have changed the face of global business, and Xers invented all of them. I talk a lot about in the book of nonprofit, sort of indie philanthropy, organizations like Architecture for Humanity, Fritz Haig's Edible Estates Movement, Majora Carter's Sustainable South Bronx. These are organizations that are sort of reinventing how to save the world, how to improve things, how to fix neighborhoods, how to, you know, look differently at what a neighborhood even is. And certainly, I mean, in entertainment, I mean, just to look at comedy, I mean, you have, I think Xers right now just really own American comedy. You know, Will Ferrell, Jack Black, Sarah Silverman, Judd Apatow, on and on and on. So, yeah, quietly, without putting on some boomerish parade about it, we seem to have slipped into positions of power, or if not power, at least influence. And I think Xers in many ways are forming the sensibility of the country right now.
Jeff Gordonnier is the editor-at-large for Details magazine and the author of X Saves the World. He spoke with Steve Paulson. Leonard Steinhorn says boomer bashing is the last acceptable prejudice in America. As a communications professor at American University, he's qualified to notice. So, to help right the wrong and restore boomers to their rightful place in history, Steinhorn wrote the book The Greater Generation, in defense of the baby boom generation. Steinhorn says boomer backlash is nothing new.
Well, boomer backlash has been going on for a while, ever since the 1960s, when boomers challenged the status quo and said that the old norms of bigotry and prejudice and sexism and racism were not sufficient for America, for American ideals, and decided to change those norms. So there's been hostility toward boomers ever since boomers, you know, shook up the China closet of American culture and demanded change. But Generation X has a very special place in boomer backlash because this is a generation that feels that boomers stole all the cultural oxygen from their youth, that every time they tried to do anything, boomers would impose their music and their 60s moments and all the rest. So I think Generation X has been very hostile to boomers almost because they're angry that boomers seem to dominate their formative years.
It's interesting, the way you put it, though. It's as though the generations on either side should have something in common, complaining about this huge group of people born from, what, 45 to 63 or something, who seem to control everything.
Well, in fact, both of those generations do harbor resentments toward boomers. That's because boomers changed things from the status quo. So the older generation, which is much more socially conservative, culturally conservative, more traditionalist, they resent all the changes, how boomers transformed America. And Gen Xers, well, you know, they sort of are tired of seeing sort of all of the video of baby boomers and sort of endless feedback loop growing up. But what's interesting about Generation X and what's fascinating here is that in terms of values and attitudes and worldview, they are basically boomers without the 60s. So in effect, they just have resentment because they feel boomers dominate the landscape. They wish they had their moment in time. But the truth is, they didn't have a 60s. Their formative years weren't that historically compelling. But they do share baby boom values. So they share boomer values, but they resent boomers.
Maybe they ought to resent the Greatest Generation then, because it's the same rebellion that happened 40 years ago without the same movement.
When you say the same rebellion that happened 40 years ago, what you're saying, I guess, is that Generation X is partaking of the boomer march toward a more equal, free, inclusive, progressive society in terms of culture, and therefore, in effect, Generation X, in terms of how they lead their lives, what their values are, what their norms are, how they're raising their kids, also rejects a lot of the values and norms that were constant in the 50s under the Greatest Generation. I mean, you have to look back to the 1950s to realize how different things are today in the baby boom era. You know, if you were black in the 1950s, it was not unusual to be going to the store and to be buying creams with the names Black No More to put on your face to look less black. Because the bottom line is that to be black in American society up until the 1960s, when boomers began to take over, was seen in the larger society as something that was to be ashamed of. With women, up until 1972, the Washington Post had separate classified ads for men and women. They had ads. I actually looked at some of these ads. I looked at ads in the New York Times. It was not unusual for an ad calling for, quote, girl, attractive, 5'5 to 5'7 in heels. We are a long way from that period in history, and it didn't just happen because Samantha wiggled her nose and bewitched and wished it to happen. It happened because individuals, people, on a daily basis, outside the media spotlight, changed families, changed schools, changed workplaces, changed attitudes, changed communities. And that really is the true revolution of the baby boom generation that doesn't show up in the history books.
It's interesting because you talk about civil rights, you talk about women's rights, you talk in the book about environmental rights and the changes that have occurred. The complaints that are coming out now, based on a lot of writing that's been done over the last 20 years or so, are about the boomers as the me generation. Who was it, Tom Wolfe, who said that originally? Mm-hmm. That was in the 80s. And about the yuppies, the boomers who love their Lexuses, the boomers who may have cared about things in the 60s, but by the 80s, 90s, and wherever it is we are now, are more interested in how much money they have in their retirement accounts. The two generations, the two definitions of the boomers, seem to coexist, and it's more which one you look at, isn't it?
Well, but you could also level those charges against previous generations. And in fact, in the 1950s, the whole sort of mockery of the Greatest Generation, that all they wanted to do was to keep up with the Joneses. And you go back and look at all the Mad magazines at the time, which is, I think, a formative publication of the baby boom generation, and they made fun of the conformity and the status seeking of the Greatest Generation. And then you go dial back to a generation before that, and people were accusing them of conspicuous consumption. So what you're basically saying is that all the other generations get a pass on those values, but only the baby boomers are held accountable. My own view is that boomers are just Americans like all these other generations. They're materialistic. That's American. But they're no more materialistic in their own context than these other generations were. Just go back and look at the history, look at the criticisms of these generations. Go back to the 1950s, and you'll see the social critics talking about the organization man and the man in the gray flannel suit and, you know, the suburban trap and all the rest. This was the criticism at the time. So I think boomers are just falling into an American tradition of materialism for good or for ill. But what people who accuse boomers of that don't recognize is, for example, how large chunk of baby boomers revitalized and created the nonprofit sector in America. Up through the 1960s in the U.S., there were only about 5,000 nonprofits per year registered with the IRS. From the late 70s onward, that number jumped to 35 to 45,000 a year. We have millions of nonprofit organizations, millions of nonprofit employees, millions of nonprofit volunteers. That didn't exist in previous generations. So when you actually look at the numbers and what people are doing beyond the media framework and the media caricature, people are giving of themselves just as they did in previous generations, but they are giving of themselves in the baby boom generation.
So in a way, what you're saying is that the Gen X and subsequent generations, Generation Next or whatever it is we call them now, should be more grateful to the boomers for those things in the way that the boomers were grateful to their previous generation?
Well, you see, the problem is that it's always easier to visualize a war and to, you know, sort of make movies about that. It's a lot more difficult to make a movie about the changes that have gone on in the family or about the changes that have gone in the workplace or about how attitudes have changed. It's sort of like that young woman basketball player who says, "I'm not a feminist." And yet, who got the ball into her hands? I mean, in the 1960s and 70s, if you had female basketball teams, they were often half court because of the perception that women couldn't play full court because they might faint. So I think what happens is we take a lot of these changes, the greater equality, the greater personal freedom, we take that for granted, and we don't realize how it came about and who made it came about.
How big do you think the differences are between generations? Or the question, I guess, is are we really just the product of our circumstances, our humanity? Are we just people no matter which generation we're in?
Well, I think to some extent we are. And when you go on a personal basis, you know, we all want to love our family and love our kids. But, you know, when you actually look at the research and this, the attitudes and the norms between generations, there really is a break between those who are older than boomers and boomers and those who are younger. And that break is one that has created an America that's far more inclusive, far more open, far more expressive, far more in favor of personal freedom, equality, women's rights, rights for minorities, than the previous generations. You go look at some of that survey research, and for years, the older generation was the one that didn't think that women should be working outside the home. That was one generation in recent years, and for many years, they refused to accept homosexuality as an acceptable way of life. For many years, according to the surveys, they resisted intermarriage, racial intermarriage. They resisted neighborhood integration. And yet, boomers are the ones who said, no, that's wrong, and now their kids are actually living those norms that boomers helped to bring into the middle and the mainstream of society. So in some ways right now, you have the full flowering of the boomer ideal in this younger generation, which is the most socially inclusive and tolerant generation in our nation's history.
Leonard Steinhorn teaches communications at American University. He's the author of The Greater Generation. Coming up, your letters in response to boomer bashing. It's to the best of our knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Recently, we aired a program called Rethinking the 60s. It contained an anti-boomer rant from, to the best of our knowledge, producer Charles Monroe Kane. That piece touched a nerve, and we were flooded with emails in response from both sides of the debate. Here's a clip.
As me and the other dads push our strollers to the coffee shop, we talk about a lot of stuff. Bottle weaning, daycare providers, and how to best administer a timeout. But one topic that is sure to come up is you. And by you, I mean the boomers, the 60s generation. And we know you well. You're our parents, our bosses, our elected officials. Look, I'm sorry about the Kennedys, but that was before I was born, folks, and I'm almost 40. I think it's time for y'all to move on. But don't fret, I got a suggestion. Two of them, actually. Quit living in the past and get the hell out of our way. You compromised, and then you romanticized your past. You're busy celebrating your youth when you should be ashamed of yourselves. You left us with a legacy of materialism and cynicism. And you know what? We don't appreciate it one bit. Enjoy your retirement. You failed.
When we aired my Gen X colleagues rant against the boomers a few weeks ago, I confess the first word to come to mind wasn't rant, but runt, as in ignorant little. Then, as I started thinking about it, I cooled off a little. After all, I know he can speak a full English sentence as well as anyone when he wants to. But he started his rant as me and the other dads push our strollers to the coffee shop, and I knew he was just posing. And he has to know that it's thanks to the generation just ahead of his that he and the other dads can appear in public pushing strollers without embarrassment. He hitchhiked to San Francisco after high school? Sounds more like the hippie most of us didn't have time to be. In fact, his rant sounded exactly like the conversations I overheard in college in the 60s, but the complaints then about parents were from kids in their teens and 20s, not from a dad close to 40. When you rail against someone's lost youth, maybe it's yours. But take heart. I'm here to tell you there's still time. I'm pushing 60 and can both look back with pleasure to the summer of love, when I was doing alternative service as a conscientious objector, and look forward to the summers of love I intend to spend with my grandson. Who knows? Maybe one day I'll write a rant that starts, "As the other grandpas and I push our strollers to the coffee shop." There. Feels good to have that off my chest. You had a lot to get off your chests, too.
Hi, this is Frank, and I'm listening to Charles's rant on WBEZ in Chicago, and I really have to take exception to the rant on the baby boomers. We lost. We should be ashamed of ourselves. Let's, on your hand, one hand, put up your fingers. Civil rights, gay rights, women's rights, voting rights, which, by the way, younger voters, historically up until maybe this election, haven't even used. And the music. We haven't even talked about the music. Get out of the way. I'm really surprised at that because it's like, you're one thing, you're sounding like every other generation that has come along that tells their parents to get out of the way. That's great. That's fine. Go on, take over. But to not even acknowledge that you're working on the foundation that was built by the boomer generation, I wonder who should be ashamed here.
Here's a response from Seth in San Francisco, who says his parents epitomized the 60s-era archetypes to a T. I could not agree with his sentiments more. I thought the piece was bold, articulate, and dead on. Beyond that, it captured the rage that many offspring of the 60s, my friends and younger family, have in common, which we simply do not find reflected anywhere in the media and is consistently denied by our families. I do think this constant backdrop of rage is a common motivator for the higher-functioning Gen Xers. I forwarded the link to my mother. Never have I had radio or any media take such a positive personal role in my life. It was a brilliant piece, and I applaud the author and whatever forces at the radio program allowed such a relevant viewpoint to be on the air.
My name is Stephanie, and I'm from Boise, Idaho. I just find this Mr. Kane's rant quite comical, and it also angers me because I haven't got a clue what he's talking about. As a baby boomer, my viewpoint is we're not the ones that brought on the materialism. I mean, he gives us a lot of credit and power, but I think we as baby boomers did a lot of good things for the country, for society, for 40-year-olds of today.
And here's a response from Danny in Lafayette, Indiana.
After listening to Charles Monroe Kane's rant on Sunday, it resonated with me in a way that no other thing has been on the radio for a while. Growing up with boomers, I never understood their fascination with Woodstock. How did a muddy rock concert that glorified drugs and casual sex change America for the better? Now I learn they are building a memorial there, a legacy to the scourge of drug abuse and STD spreading uncommitted sex. You have to understand that Vietnam, the civil rights movement, the Kennedys, the moon landing are to us what FDR, the Great Depression, and World War II were to you, just history. You constantly call yourselves the children of the 60s, always children. You think you're going to live forever, but you actually fear death, perpetual youth, even in the face of death.
And here's one last letter from David in Arcata, California. It was a horrible time when we all failed, had some success, suffered, and were at times infantile, courageous, and self-centered on all sides of the spectrum. Not a time to be glorified, except for its passion. But we went on to get our lives together, stomach our anger, and become co-opted, a 60s phrase, in order to raise children like CMK, who now rightfully point out that we dropped the baton. Why? Because we were worn out and needed to earn a living, do music lessons, help with homework, and do treasure hunts for birthday parties. But at least in our day, many of us spoke out against what was wrong, took to the streets, or risked military discipline, and eventually helped stop the horrific, unjust war of our time. Gen X today can't even drag itself to the voting booth. Thanks to everyone for getting in touch and giving us your take. And for those of you who haven't written, we'd love to hear from you. Is generational warfare on your mind? Or is it merely the construct of a few loud voices? You can get in touch with us through our website at ttbook.org. Leave us a message while you're there. We always love to hear from you. Lisa Chamberlain is a Gen X journalist and author. As Chamberlain sees it, the economy has been a huge influence on Generation X. It's made them innovators and free thinkers who operate outside the status quo. If you want to get inside the head of a Gen Xer, this scene from the teen movie Say Anything, starring John Cusack as Lloyd Dobler, says it all.
So, Lloyd, you graduated Lakewood, right?
Yes, sir.
What are you going to do now?
Yeah, Lloyd. What are your plans for the future? Spend as much time possible with Diane before she leaves.
Seriously, Lloyd?
I'm totally and completely serious.
No, really?
You mean like career? I don't know. I've thought about this quite a bit, sir, and I would have to say, considering what's waiting out there for me, I don't want to sell anything, buy anything, or process anything as a career. I don't want to sell anything bought or processed, or buy anything sold or processed, or process anything sold, bought, or processed, or repair anything sold, bought, or processed. You know, as a career, I don't want to do that. So, my father's in the Army. He wants me to join. But I can't work for that corporation. So what I've been doing lately is kickboxing.
Chamberlain writes about the rise of Gen X in her book Slackonomics. She told Ann Strainchamps that Gen X has blazed a different path than its baby boomer parents.
The cliche, of course, now of baby boomers, and, you know, these cliches are, you can only take them so far, but, you know, the type A personality, the yuppie, the, you know, self-absorbed, now, you know, Dennis Hopper is doing his retirement plan commercials. That is sort of the stereotype of the boomer, whereas with Generation X, there's much more emphasis on balance, balancing life, work, family, and creative time. A lot of people always talk about, oh, it's so hard to balance, you know, family life and work life. Well, there's this whole other component for Generation X, and that's creative time. You know, that's a new development where people expect to have some time to work on that screenplay or do the documentary.
Yeah, there's been a lot of coverage lately about the anger later generations have towards the baby boomers, and in particular the anger of the Gen Xers, mm-hmm. who accuse the boomers of, everything from having failed to having sold out. Where's all this coming from?
I think it's partly, you know, it had sort of brewed for a little while, maybe not quite so vociferously, but the idea that, I mean, first of all, there's economic inequality that has skyrocketed. And I think, rightly or wrongly, the boomers are taking a lot of blame for that. Now we're sort of in a situation where, I can't remember the latest numbers, but it's something like 80% of the country thinks we're on the wrong track. And the people who have been in charge while we were sort of developing that opinion were the boomers. So I think it's both political and economic at this point. And whether it's all the boomers' fault is probably open to debate. But there is a lot of anger out there right now towards boomers. There is no question about it.
How do you see that showing up?
Well, definitely in the political culture, but a lot has been made about Barack Obama's rise and the fact that even McCain, you know, he's not a boomer either. And that, you know, that the whole kind of boomer leadership era needs to come to an end. That seems to be a pretty predominant feeling right now.
Is it partly driven by resentment? Do you think that the economy favored the boomers? You know, they wanted it all,
exactly.
And to a certain extent, they got it all. And here come the Gen Xers, and they're not getting squat.
Right, right, exactly. I mean, part of the income and the wealth gap is partly a generational gap. As wealth was concentrating further and further at the top, basically is also concentrating in older and older generations. And now we're at a point where people are concerned that the Hillary Clinton supporters who are now refusing to support Barack Obama, that they're going to become sort of like this election's Naderites, mm-hmm. where, you know, these are the kind of the political suicide bombers. And so I think that people are starting to fear that Obama now will lose because boomers are sort of sabotaging him.
Boy, it really does sound, doesn't it, like a very classic generational gap and sort of like this kind of squabbles teenagers have with their parents, you know, kind of wanting to insist, no, we're grown up now. You know, we can drive, we can vote. It's time to hand over the keys.
Right, right. But meanwhile, we're still not really, our hands are not quite yet on the levers. So,
and the parents don't want to give up the car.
Right, right, exactly. And what's interesting is that, you know, the boomers now, I mean, they're still in their jobs. They're not retiring, and they're working into their 70s, and, you know, they're sort of bequeathing what some people are, you know, feel is a sort of an economic and a environmental disaster on younger generations. And meanwhile, we're just sort of lumbering off the cliff. And I think there's a lot of anxiety about that.
And boomers, on their part, many of them are scornful of Gen Xers for having been slackers and uninvolved and unmotivated, you know,
right.
Kids who kind of just slacked off for a couple of decades, and now they have the gall to turn around and criticize us.
I guess to the extent that they think about anybody else at all, yes, maybe that's what they think.
Where do you see all this animosity going?
Well, that's interesting. I mean, I think that the next 10 years of decision making are going to be very crucial to, you know, what direction the country and even the world go in. And I think Generation X really feels that it's time to apply some new thinking to policy problems, to environmental problems, definitely to economic problems. And if those solutions get frustrated, if Generation X is not able to have an impact, you know, I'm not sure. I hate to make predictions, but the next 10 years, I think, are going to be pretty important.
Looking far ahead, a lot is also being written about the generation that comes after Gen X.
I know. We're already on to Generation Y.
the kids who are in their 20s now, Gen Y or the millennials, they've been called. You know, it's a very big generation. They're very networked together. They've grown up digital. They're very involved in social activism. And they're not as angry at their parents.
Right.
What is going to happen when they come of age?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, one of the things that I think Generation X is also grumbling about is that, like, you know, we went first from being obsessed with boomer and boomer culture, and now all of a sudden we're already on to Generation Y, and they're, you know, they're in their mid-20s. So, yeah, there's a lot of, you know, everyone wants to know what's next, and now that Generation X is, like, pushing mid-40s, you know, we're already kind of old news, which is irritating. But Generation Y, that is the characterization. But I would always, you know, as we first started talking about, there were a lot of characterizations of Generation X that ended up changing over time. So at the moment, Generation Y is considered this sort of very digital savvy, you know, they didn't have to bridge the analog and digital worlds the way Generation X did. They were just born into it. They're very, you know, socially oriented, group oriented, whereas Generation X was very individualistic. And these characterizations may stick or they may not as they grow up and as things change. I don't know that Generation X is necessarily angry at their parents and that there was this big gap between the kids and the parents so much. It's more the larger picture of the direction that the world went in. Culturally, I think generational gaps are closing, or they're getting more and more narrow, and that's definitely true with Generation Y.
Lisa Chamberlain is a regular contributor to the New York Times and the author of the book Slackonomics. Coming up, a novelist follows baby boomers into voluntary suicide. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Christopher Buckley is the best-selling author of 11 books, including God Is My Broker and his latest, Supreme Courtship. As a father, Buckley was prompted to look at his own generation, the boomers, and the legacy it was leaving his children. The result? The novel Boomsday, which tells the story of a runaway piece of legislation urging boomers to commit voluntary suicide for tax incentives. Buckley read an excerpt for Steve Paulson.
Thank you, Wendy Wong in Washington, for that report on the deteriorating economic situation. In Florida today, another attack on a gated community by youths protesting the recent hike in the Social Security payroll tax. Several hundred people in their 20s stormed the gates of a retirement community in the early hours this morning. Residents were assaulted as they played golf. Demonstrators seized carts and drove them under water hazards and bunkers. Others used spray paint and garden implements to write slogans on the greens. One such message, gouged into the 18th green, read, "Boomsday Now." The word refers to the term economists use for the date this year when the first of the nation's 77 million so-called baby boomers began to retire with full Social Security benefits. The development has put a tremendous strain on the system that in turn has sent shockwaves through the entire U.S. economy. A maintenance worker at the golf course said it might be, quote, weeks before residents were able to play golf. In other news today, the vice president has shot yet another lawyer, this time, he says, in self-defense.
That is good. I would think it would be almost impossible to write a funny novel about the looming problems of paying for Social Security. Whatever made you want to take on this subject?
Well, I like a challenge. It is a challenge, Social Security. When you think Social Security, you don't immediately slap your thigh and double over. But, you know, I like to write about, or I tend to write about things that I suppose get me angry, and the government's continuing fumbling of the ball and passing along all this debt to future generations. I have young kids, and they're going to be paying these Social Security bills for our retiring boomer generation. So I thought, well, let's try to take that on. Again, the trick is finding the satire in it. In the conceit of Boomsday, this novel, is this young woman who has a personal reason to be angry about the prior generation doing this to her generation. And she sort of mischievously proposes via a senator whom she's befriended that one way to solve the Social Security problem would be for the government to incentivize suicide for retiring baby boomers. So if you kill yourself at 65, you get a, you know, a big tax relief passage. If you,
I guess you don't get it yourself, but it's passed down to your
descendants. Well, the estate, you know, it can conveyed to your children. So this senator who's ambitious and running for president proposes it. And, you know, Washington being Washington, it starts as an absurdity and then becomes sort of more and more plausible. Of course, it doesn't happen in the end. It's a little bit, I emphasize, I'm not in any way comparing myself with Jonathan Swift, but you remember his modest proposal that the poor of Ireland solve their hunger problems by eating their children.
But what you're tapping into is not just the financial problem, but also the generational warfare that's sort of bubbling underneath the surface. I mean, this is not just about young people, let's say in their 20s, who are upset about the coming financial crisis. It's also about just general anger at all those baby boomers out there. And in your novel, your main character, Cassandra Devine, who is just generally furious at her own father.
Yeah. In politics, always look for the personal motive. And in Cassandra's case, she was an honors student at high school, and she gets into Yale. And it turns out that her dad, who's trying to do a dot-com startup, has used the college money. So she doesn't go to Yale. Instead, she goes into the U.S. Army and ends up as a public affairs officer in Bosnia. So she's mad. But that's just a way of, you know, making dramatic, if you will, or personal, a broader complex. I am a card-carrying member of the boomer generation. And I am often appalled by our self-indulgence. You know, I mean, as always, there are complexities and ironies and contradictions. I think boomers are very good parents, for instance. I think we've probably, as a generation, spent more time with our children than our parents did. And yet, I think there is a self-indulgence that tends to shunt aside the consciousness about these problems. I mean, I'm very cognizant of the fact that we are saddling future generations with terrible, terrible debt.
When you talk about self-indulgence, what do you mean?
Oh, turn on TV. You know,
I thought the TV was appealing to a younger generation than
the
boomers.
The word yuppie seems to have gone into retirement, but I'm talking about what we used to call the yuppie mentality, you know, the obsession with having the sub-zero refrigerator because, as David Brooks says, zero just isn't cold enough, or expensive cars and this and that. I think the boomer generation has elevated consumerism into an art form. And I don't think that is our generation's most attractive quality.
And yet this is also the generation that was very idealistic at one point. I mean, just think about the 60s, and it does make you wonder what happened.
Well, yeah. I mean, turn on the evening news, and you see these ads. And the music for all these ads is invariably some song you first heard at Woodstock. You know, only now it's being used to promote free checking at Chase Manhattan. it's really, where have all the flowers gone? You know, they're into the ATM machines. It's, well, every generation is idealistic, and then every generation, I guess, you know, gets old. And this is not, I mean, there are a lot of people who were idealistic in the 60s and who remained idealistic, and they, you know, they lived lives of service. So I certainly don't mean to dump on the whole generation, but by and large, there's been a certain amount of selling out, I would say.
Now, as you have said, you yourself are a baby boomer. Would you care to defend your generation?
Well, you know, I haven't come to denounce my generation, but I'm just saying that I don't think it's likely that future historians are going to call us the greatest generation. You know, we were the, as President Clinton said when he spoke at those D-Day commemoration ceremonies some years ago, we are the children. He looked at the veterans who were assembled there, you know, who had stormed the heights of Pointe du Hoc and come ashore in Omaha Beach. And he said a line that was sort of semi-memorable. He said, "We are the children of your sacrifice." Look, if you could be born at any time in human history, wouldn't you probably pick being born in America sometime starting in 1946? I mean, what generation in what country has enjoyed such abundant blessings as ours? I'm just saying that I'm not sure we have proved ourselves completely worthy of that benison.
To get back to your novel for a moment.
I'm sounding very pompous, I must say. I apologize.
No, quite all right. This rather outrageous idea that maybe there should be euthanasia for people who get old to help defray the costs of the coming Social Security crisis. And I have to say, I love the phrase that your heroine, Cassandra, uses, transitioning.
Voluntary transitioning.
As they transition out of this lifetime. Spell out this modest proposal. How might this work?
Oh, well, it's, you know, it's an idea as absurd as Jonathan Swift's proposal that poor Irish eat their children. But as a comic device, the details are that, you know, the government would set up transitioning centers where you would go in and lie down and have piped in music and, you know, one last martini, and they stick the vein. It's sort of, you know, lethal injection with a smiley face. It's a sort of a, I suppose, a dystopian version of how it might all end up. Cassandra's not a, you know, terrible person. She's actually a good person. She intends it purely as a device to get the government focused in on that. But what happens is this senator sort of carries the ball, and it becomes a, you know, something that gets talked about on the Sunday morning talk shows.
Well, one thing that strikes me is that, I mean, of course, this is an absurd scenario you've created. I mean, but partly because the problems of dealing with Social Security payments seems far off. It might not seem so far off in 10 or 20 years. And who knows, maybe this voluntary transitioning won't seem so crazy at some point.
Well, unless it's fixed, this is going to be a problem at least as large as energy. And it's going to be very noticeable. I mean, there's 77 million baby boomers, and they started to retire last year. And that's going to put a terrible strain. And the math, again, that you mentioned, when Social Security was enacted, there were 15 workers for every single retiree. There are now 3 workers for every retiree. Of course, in those days, we didn't live as long. It's the complexities of modern life. I mean, we live so long now, and it costs a lot to live long. But the quality of life is, well, often not so good. Anyway, by solving one problem, we seem to stumble into another. But that's, I suppose, always been the case.
Steve Paulson spoke with novelist Christopher Buckley about his novel Boomsday. Buckley's latest is called Supreme Courtship. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like to comment on what you've heard, we'd love to hear from you. You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. You can buy a CD of the show by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 914A, Boomer Backlash. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This program was produced by Veronica Rickert, with help from Ann Strangechamps, Mary Lou Finnegan, Charles Monroe Kane, and Doug Gordon. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast.
PRI, Public Radio International.